This is Central Time. Now, the latest Marquette University Law School poll found major partisan differences on issues including President Biden's pandemic response, Afghans coming into the U.S., and views of the 2020 presidential election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think Americans are so divided along partisan lines on so many different issues? We're going to hear about a few of those coming up, and you could join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll and developer of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, our regular listeners know that you do a lot of Wisconsin-specific polls. This is one of your national ones, right?
That's right. We're now doing a national poll every 2 months, focusing on the U.S. Supreme Court and also other national issues. And right now we're talking about some of those other national issues. But this is not to say we're not doing the Wisconsin polls anymore. We certainly are. There'll be one of those next month.
You haven't forgotten us. Now that you've hit
no,
the
we
national
haven't forgotten
all right.
at all.
Let's get into some results here. Afghanistan, one of the big issues you tackled here. You asked people what they thought of President Biden's handling of the Afghanistan withdrawal and questions about what people thought about the necessity, the need to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. Can you share some of your top findings?
Yes, and here there's an interesting mix of results. Only 36% approve of the way Biden handled the withdrawal. 63% disapprove. But what about withdrawing troops as a matter of principle? 74% think we should have withdrawn all of our troops. Just 26% say we should have left troops there. And on the long run question, was the war worth it? Just 25% think it was, 74% think it was not. So I think there's a pretty clear picture here that on the goal of withdrawing all U.S. troops, it's 3-1 in favor of that outcome. But in terms of the perception of how President Biden handled the withdrawal, it's pretty negative by almost a 2-1 margin.
A running theme through your results is a partisan difference. But on that Biden administration handling, even among Democrats, there was a fair amount of disapproval of the handling. A majority of Democrats supported him, but this is one of the issues even among Democrats, Biden didn't fare as well.
That's exactly right. And you know, the big headline probably should be, when is there not a big partisan split right. in American politics these days? But that actually is one of the things that's interesting in this survey. There are some things of partisan agreement and then either more or less intense disagreement. On the question of Biden's handling of the withdrawal, it's not at all surprising that just 6% of Republicans approve, 94% disapprove. But among Democrats, 68% approve, 32% disapprove. And that's more striking because Democrats have approved of Biden's handling of his job overall by 90% or more since he took office. So in that sense, a 68% approval rating among Democrats is actually, I think, an important indicator of how even in the president's party, the withdrawal was not seen as being handled well. And among independents, it's 2-1, 66% disapprove, 33% approve.
How about the partisan breakdown when it comes to the idea of whether or not it was right to withdraw from Afghanistan, regardless of the handling, and whether the war was worth it?
And here we see smaller partisan differences. Republicans are evenly divided on withdrawing troops. 50 support withdrawing the troops, 49 opposed. Independents, it's 78% in favor, and Democrats, 89%. So there's some partisan difference there, but a Republican split of 50-50 is awfully even compared to that 6-94 that we saw on Biden's handling. And on what's the war worth it, majorities of each of the three partisan groups say it was not worth it. 58% of Republicans, 78% of independents, and 85% of Democrats. So again, I think the conclusion is across party groups, there's reasonable agreement that getting out was the right thing and that the war wasn't worth it, but then massive and normal partisan divide on Biden's handling of it, with a warning sign to Democrats that there's some dissatisfaction within the party as well.
With that majority, as you said, in each group, that the war wasn't worth it. I mean, that's very striking. This 20-year war covering multiple presidential administrations. What do you make of that tide of sentiment in American among the American population?
Yeah, this has varied hugely. If we went back to the first year or even two that we were involved in Afghanistan, people saw it as successful, and it was a very high worth it score on that in 2002-2003. We've been there so long that I think the benefits are somewhat lost, and for that matter, the costs have been somewhat muted as our involvement has wound down over the years. Frankly, Afghanistan was rarely in the news over the last 10 years or so.
We are talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, looking at the latest survey results on Afghanistan. Well, coming up, we'll get into President Biden's approval ratings and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Why do we see, big picture, why do we see such partisan divides on so many issues these days in American politics? Do you see ways to bridge the gap? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about partisan differences on Afghanistan, coronavirus, and more with Marquette University Law School poll director Charles Franklin, out with a new poll this week. Charles, overall approval of the Biden administration. I've been seeing other national polls showing a decline in approval ratings in large part since the Afghanistan withdrawal. What did you find?
Yeah, we're in line with that. We have 48% approve of his overall handling of his job, 52% disapprove. That's a 10-point drop from our July national survey when he was at 58% approve. Also, that net minus four points more disapprove than approve, is right in line with the average of national polling, though there are some polls that are showing lower levels of approval. But the average of the polls and ours agree on this net margin of minus 4 points for him.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Becky is with us in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest thought that this could be comparable to the Korean War in that it didn't do anything for the United States and everything went back to the way it was before we met.
Becky, you're kind of breaking up there, but interesting question, Charles. Do we have comparative data for something like the end of the Korean War, or at least the armed conflict part of the Korean War, or Vietnam, for that matter, when it comes to polling and approval of American achievements or failure to make those achievements in those wars?
Right. Well, actually, I could have planted this question in the sense that I looked that up, but I looked it up a few years ago. What I'll tell you is that, of course, with Vietnam, the war became increasingly unpopular while we were there. And so while initially supported by a lot of people in 64, 65, even 66, that approval fell dramatically. Also, when I looked at Korea 10 years after Korea had ended, more people said it was not worth it than that it was worth it. So in that sense, what we're seeing here is not out of line with those two earlier limited but pretty substantial wars that we fought.
Another issue you surveyed people on, Charles, was their faith, their trust in the outcome of the 2020 presidential elections. Hot news story today is the Arizona review of one county's ballots coming out today. Other states looking at maybe reviewing 2020 again. What did you find when you asked people about that?
Yeah, we asked, how confident are you that the votes and the count were accurate in the election? 60% say they're very or somewhat confident. 40% say they're not confident or not at all confident. So that's, again, the 60-40 split is pretty much in line with what we've seen in other national polling. But here there are not only sharp partisan differences, but also some differences within the Republican Party that I think are worth attending to.
Yeah, what did you see within the Republican Party on that?
So we ask people if they think of themselves as Republican, Independent, or Democrat. But if you say Republican, we say, do you think of yourself as a strong Republican or a not so strong Republican? Among strong Republicans, 92% are not confident in the election outcome. Among not so strong Republicans, that drops to 71%. And among independents who lean Republican and generally vote Republican, that drops again to 61%. So it's a majority that are not confident in the party, regardless of strength. But it also reveals how important for the core base of the party, those strong Republicans, a 92-8 balance on not confident helps explain why Republican leadership is experiencing or suffering so much pressure from within their party base.
Well, hold on. Is that a chicken?
Some variation in the party.
Is that a chicken or an egg there? Are people thinking that because many people leading the Republican Party, including the former president, are pushing the narrative that there was something wrong with the election?
I think it certainly comes from former President Trump and the narrative about it. What we find is that relatively few people have changed their partisanship over the last year. And of those who've changed, it's relatively symmetric, only about 2% who have gone from Republican to Democrat or Democrat to Republican, a little bit more that have moved to independent, but again, pretty symmetric. So it's not a change in the composition of the parties so much as it is the rhetoric of party leadership, not just from President Trump, but from other party leaders who feed that lack of confidence and raise questions and doubts about the election. But it's clear that it's virtually unanimous among the strongest Republicans. Now, conversely, it's 90% or so among Democrats as well, who believe that the election was accurately counted. So we started this conversation about polarization in part by party. This is a prime example of that. 96% of strong Democrats are confident in the election outcome.
And just in our last minute, we've got this race to get people vaccinated as the Delta variant of coronavirus goes around. What did you hear from people about their vaccination status, and especially unvaccinated people, whether they were still planning to get vaccinated?
Yeah, and here we have 76% who said they've already been vaccinated. That matches what the Centers for Disease Control is reporting. And of that 24% who've not been vaccinated, about 58% say that they will definitely not get vaccinated. So that's the difficult group to reach and to change their opinion. Or failing that, that's likely to set the groundwork for where we will be on the unvaccinated for a while yet. There's another group that says they probably won't get vaccinated. But we'll take the probably there as something that might change.
Charles, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He talked to us about the latest nationwide survey, which highlighted partisan differences across a lot of different issues. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For this week's edition of Food Friday, we're celebrating the start of fall with a favorite cold weather meal, soup. Soup's a great way to stay cozy and warm when the weather starts to get chilly, and our next guest says it has some real health benefits along the way. Julie Harrington is a chef and registered dietitian. She's the co-author of the Healing Soup Cookbook, Hearty Recipes to Boost Immunity and Restore Health. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. So I'm actually here in New Jersey right now, so a little far away from Wisconsin, but soups all around are going to fit in anyone's fall menu.
Definitely. And I think we'd like New Jersey soups here in Wisconsin. I got no problem with that. So soup, we know it's warm. We know it's, you know, nourishing, but healthy. Can you make the case for it that soup can be a really good source for healthy food?
Yes. So in this book, we talk a lot about the health benefits and the anti-inflammatory benefits. And when it comes to building a soup, you're using a lot of vegetables, you're using broths as healing properties. You can add in different food groups to meet nutritional needs. And you can really mix and match with different flavor profiles as well.
Here's what I worry about, though. There's a part of my brain, Julie, that when I hear healthy soup, and I make a lot of soup, I love soup. When I hear healthy soup, I had this cookbook, I think it was for British hippies, and it was supposed to be healthy food, and it had recipes like flavorless lentil soup and bland and depressing spinach soup. Those weren't the actual titles, but they could have been. My worry is if you're telling me, Rob, this is a healthy soup, it's going to be bland and boring. Talk me out of
it. No way. No way here. Because as a chef, food has to taste good. So that is my main priority. I'm not going to serve cardboard, or I'm not going to serve something that people are not going to enjoy eating. So first things first, has to taste delicious. And then I'm really kind of working backwards and thinking about building a recipe around specific health needs or health concerns. And with anti-inflammatory, it's really focusing on these whole foods, fiber-rich fruits, vegetables, our whole grain, lean meats, and that's really where that anti-inflammatory benefit comes from.
All right, cold flu season coming up. What do we want? I mean, chicken soup. Everybody thinks about chicken soup. Is there really something to that?
Yeah. So in our book, we actually really talk about that and the healing benefits of like a nice warm broth. We typically think about that when we have a cold, but that steam will actually help our sinuses. So that's going to be really great. And then also rehydration, because a lot of times when we're sick, we are dehydrated. So that broth-based soup is going to be helpful in that aspect.
Talking to Julie Harrington, chef and registered dietitian, co-author of the book, The Healing Soup Cookbook. You could join in this Food Friday conversation, by the way, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite soup to make, to eat? Do you have a favorite soup for when you're feeling under the weather? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You've got some recipes for us, Julie. We've got them up at wpr.org/foodfriday. Miso soup. You can buy miso. I've had it at Japanese restaurants. You can buy miso as a sort of tub of glop. Tell us about your miso soup and why we want to eat it.
So miso soup is actually so easy to make, and you probably walk by miso in the grocery store every time you're there. A lot of people just don't know how to cook with it or use it, but it has this really rich umami flavor. And since it's a fermented soybean, it will last a really long time in your fridge. And I like to use it to provide that umami-based flavor without going overboard with different stocks and broths, and you can make your own at home very easily and get that same experience.
And yet, even if we're not making something that we're calling miso soup, miso can be like, it can replace your bouillon or your stock, right?
Exactly. So even in some of the recipes, we just use water and some miso instead of broth.
What are your tips if we want to make our own broth from the ground up?
Perfect. So we have a whole chapter of that. We have your classic vegetable. We have chicken broth, beef stock, bone broth, mushroom broth. There's so many different broths you can build. So my biggest tip, though, is as you're cooking throughout any stage of cooking, whatever you're making, save the scraps. So save the ends of the onion, save the carrot peel, save the ends of that celery, because put in a freezer bag. And once that's full, you can utilize scraps to help make your stock or broth. So you're not buying these whole foods again to just end up discarding later on.
And I want to check out another recipe now. This one sounds great. A creamy basil tomato soup. Tell us a little bit about this guy, please.
Oh, I love tomato soup. And this just takes it up a level with some basil in there. Just adds those layers of flavor. So you'll see in this book, we have your classics here, but then also taking it up a notch with adding maybe a new ingredient or a new flavor profile or just that added twist that maybe you didn't think to add yourself, just to enhance the flavors.
And you say, you know, I think, oh, this time of year, we still got some fresh tomatoes here in Wisconsin. You say actually canned tomatoes can be as good or maybe even better depending on the time of year.
Yep. So canned tomatoes, they actually contain more lycopene than fresh tomatoes. Once your fresh tomato is at that peak ripeness, that's going to contain the most lycopene. But since our canned tomatoes are processed and put in those cans, it's preserving that lycopene. And lycopene is a really great antioxidant that can help with anti-inflammatory benefits, but then also known for support with prostate cancer.
One of the things I get most excited about this year, Julie, food-wise, is squash and pumpkins. And I love making soup with both of those things. Do you have any favorite ways to use your winter squashes or your pumpkins this time of year in your soups?
Yes, I love butternut squash soup. It's one of my favorites. Mm. I actually have some frozen in my freezer right now that I definitely need to thaw out. So when it comes to choosing your squash, definitely think about the flavor profile you're looking for. So some are a little bit sweeter. Some have a little bit more texture than others. You can leave it in cubes. You can puree them up. So they're very versatile. And there's so many different kinds of squash out there. We typically always gravitate towards the same kind, but definitely venture out this season and maybe try a delicata squash or a kombucha squash or even a honey nut squash versus your butternut.
We heard from Martha on Facebook who says her favorite soup is in cold weather is French onion soup. Martha says they just bought some onions to make it. Now, I love eating French onion soups at restaurants, Julie. For some reason, it seems like a hard one to make at home, so I've never tried. Am I wrong?
It's just more of a lengthy process because to really get that rich French onion flavor, you have to caramelize your onions. And it's a slow and steady process. So low and slow heat will really caramelize those onions and really adapt and develop that flavor that we're looking for in that broth. But it's actually pretty easy to make. You just have to have a little patience.
Now, here's a divisive issue in my family. Beets. I like them. Nobody else in my immediate household does. You brought us a recipe for borscht, which features beets, of course. And I never really thought of it. Borscht, usually you cook the vegetables separate and then put them in the broth as opposed to they cook entirely in the broth.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, why continue to make it harder for yourself and make that recipe from start to finish in that pot? So I always say cook smarter, not harder. You can easily buy pre-chopped veggies for these soups. You can buy the broth if you don't want to make your own broth. It's whatever is going to get you to eat this nourishing soup. I'm all about that. That's my biggest thing.
What are the flavors you like to have in with the beets in that borscht?
So the beet one, actually, the co-author developed that recipe. So she would need to answer that question more of her development of that
gotcha.
Recipe.
Okay. Are you a beet fan yourself, though?
I love beets.
Okay.
Especially roasted beets with yes. squash. I think that's delicious for a nice top of a salad or a side dish.
We are on the same page there. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in West Salem. Jeff, hi.
Yes, hi. I was just heard you mention about the lycoproteins or whatever it is, or lycopenes in tomatoes when you can them. I was wondering if they're just as good frozen as they are canned.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I don't feel like I see frozen tomatoes that much, Julie. Do you?
No, frozen you don't really see, but if the conversation's more going to what's going to be the better choice, fresh, frozen, canned, all of them are great choices because they're all going to get you to eat some more fruits and vegetables, especially the vegetable category. But you just need to be aware of frozen. Now it's going into a package. They could be adding other stuff to the package. But say broccoli, for example, you have frozen broccoli. That is picked at its peak ripeness. So it's locking in all that nutrition the same as that fresh. So the nutrition components are very similar, but now you just have to be a little bit more aware now that it could be adding a cheese sauce or even when it says lightly seasoned, it might be just light in taste, but not light in sodium, for example.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We heard from Marsha on Facebook. Speaking of that broccoli, Marsha's favorite is cream of broccoli with cheese. Julie,
yes.
First of all, your thoughts on cheese and soup. And remember, you're talking to Wisconsin here.
Well, I mean, I love cheese, so there's no question there. I like to add a lot of my cheese as toppings just because then everyone can kind of cater to how much or how little they do want. But I mean, you can't have a soup cookbook without broccoli cheddar soup in there.
A lot of times when I start making a soup, I don't know what kind of soup it's going to end up being. What's in my fridge? What kind of spices do I want to add along the way?
It's just soup.
Yes, exactly. I love doing that. And sometimes I have this quandary at the end. Sometimes it's clear I don't cream it. I don't blend it. Sometimes it's obviously a blended soup. I'm on the fence. What makes you decide whether to blend it at the end or not?
I mean, I guess the flavors in there and the textures, if I like having a little texture in my soup. So more al dente vegetables instead of like really soft vegetables in my soup, or adding a grain. So for all of those, I'm going to keep them broth-based. But something that maybe has a lot of kind of mushy texture, so say my butternut squash soup, I puree that because everything's sitting in that pot for a long time for that squash to get nice and tender. It's going to take a while. So I don't want mushy squash. I like that pureed instead.
Awesome. Julie, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me. So I hope everyone cooks soup this fall.
I'm probably going to make some tomorrow or maybe during the Packer game on Sunday. I don't know.
There you go.
That's Julie Harrington, chef and registered dietitian. She's co-author of the Healing Soup Cookbook, Hearty Recipes to Boost Immunity and Restore Health. Find a few of the recipes she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday and tell us about your favorite soup over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.